Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Open the pod bay doors, please, Josh.
I'm sorry, Michael. I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
This week's mission, our Sacred Cow review of the famously confounding 2001 A Space Odyssey.
I'm scared, Josh.
Me too, Michael. Helping us unravel the mysteries of Kubrick's 1968 sci-fi classic is Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. That's Michael Starchild Phillips, actually.
Thank you.
Michael and I are going to also count down the top five Stanley Kubrick scenes. That and more.
My instructor, Mr. Langley, taught me a song, Josh. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Your answer to. I'm half crazy.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM9.
And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM9.
It's always great to hear from listeners who use one of the services that help sponsor the show. And we got this note from Dan Golden about Squarespace. I've been using Squarespace for about 4 years now and love it. Being an artist and designer, I was looking for a website service that had clean, contemporary templates, was super easy to use, and also affordable. Squarespace fit the bill on all accounts. On top of everything, Squarespace has some of the best customer service I've ever experienced. Recently, Squarespace upgraded to version 6, which features new, super fresh templates that are easy to customize. And they've also integrated commerce to the list of options, so it's easy for me to sell products through my site as well. All in all, I've been extremely happy with Squarespace and would highly recommend it to any of your listeners looking to set up a website or a blog. Coincidentally, I've also been an Audible subscriber from before they started sponsoring Film Spotting. I'm starting to wonder if something funny is going on here. As a special thank you, I'd like to send Adam and Josh my pillows. Please have a look and let me know which two you like the best. And Dan's site, it's simple here, dangolden.com. I don't know. I don't think I've ever received a pillow before, but sounds great. And Michael, since you're helping us out here, maybe we'll see if we can get one for you as well.
Dan, where the hell is my pillow? Dan, my pillow, please. So try Squarespace. You can start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM9 to get 20% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. At Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You're listening to Film Spotting. There will be no fighting in the war room as Michael and I count down the top five Stanley Kubrick scenes later in the show. And yes, I did say Michael and I because Adam, well, he's under the weather. The daunting prospect, just the mere prospect of reviewing 2001, which he was worried about, got into his head. Instead of blowing his mind, the movie blew his vocal cords. He can't talk. Is there a little bit of you left there, Adam?
I am here. I sound a bit like a machine, though. Oh my!
Sounds,
I'm gonna stop talking now.
So it's like Snake Plissken. Snake.
Earlier, we identified Harvey Firestein as the appropriate source for that voice. But you better rest now. Take it easy for a little bit. We'll try to see if we can get you to chime in here again as the show goes on. We are going to get to the Overlook Hotel and lots of other memorably sinister locations in just a bit.
But first, it's time to go down the lane, around the corner, and beyond the infinite with our Sacred Cow discussion of a movie that recently turned 45, and it doesn't look a day over 30, I think. 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Good evening, Dave.
How you doing, Hal?
Everything's running smoothly, and you?
Oh, not too bad.
Have you been doing some more work?
A few sketches.
May I see them?
Sure.
That's a very nice rendering, Dave. I think you've improved a great deal. Can you hold it a bit closer?
Sure.
That's Dr. Hunter, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
Well, forgive me for being so inquisitive. But during the past few weeks, I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Well, it's rather difficult to define. Perhaps I'm just projecting my own concern about it. I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say.
45 years ago, 1 year before Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, Stanley Kubrick blew people's minds with 2001, A Space Odyssey. He gave audiences a glimpse of their futures with Pan Am flights not just across the country or the continent, but the galaxy. He also gave a glimpse of their past, opening with one of the most famous and most referenced cinematic sequences ever, The Dawn of Man. It has the monolith, the music, Thus Spake Zarathustra, all culminating with that memorable match cut. It was like nothing audiences had seen before. Now, these sacred cow discussions are chances for us to force ourselves to reconsider a movie we've seen once, perhaps even multiple times, but don't truly feel like we know or have properly wrestled with. Michael, you've been a part of several of these conversations, including Raiders of the Lost Ark, To Kill a Mockingbird, and we did another Kubrick film as well, The Shining. Having been in Toronto recently for the festival, though, I'm guessing maybe you didn't have time to rewatch it to prepare for this.
When... I actually did.
Oh, you did? Good,
I,
good.
I take my commitments seriously here. I did see 2001 again recently, and actually for a class I was teaching a while back, 2-3 years ago, I saw it again. Then, so I've seen it twice in the last 3 years, but up until 3 years ago, I hadn't seen it for 20 years probably.
Okay.
And in a way, I didn't want to mess with my feelings about it. Sometimes you're more eager to kind of go back and challenge your own perceptions of a film than others, and this is one that, since I consider it Kubrick's last great movie, I almost was a little frightened to go back to it, but I was happily surprised to see that it still messed with me in all the right ways.
Well, listener Christopher Reese from Lexington, Kentucky, shared his thoughts after seeing the film on where he thinks 2001 stands, and we'll share those with you here. Christopher says, I'm one of those daring or perhaps foolish, depending on your point of view, people who do not think this film is a masterpiece or even particularly compelling. It is a genius piece of photography, production design, and special effects. However, ultimately, I think the film is a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. I do not think this is Kubrick's fault necessarily. He seemed to be interested in creating a completely visual and oral experience that would create a definite emotional experience for the audience. But I am not sure he meant for it to mean anything per se. But because film critics and students have created this overinflated vision of Kubrick overall, and especially of this movie, the film must be saying something so profound that we cannot grasp it. So what do you think, Michael? Would you say Christopher's right, or is Kubrick's film truly a masterpiece, the rare technical marvel that also provoked you to grasp onto something profound about the human condition and ultimately the universe? Is 2001 a sacred cow or a false idol?
I do consider this Kubrick's last great film, as I say, and I think it's easy to feel aced out by the movie because it's confounding in many ways, and even though it comes at you in a fairly straightforward four section progression, you know, begins with the Dawn of Man when you see this mysterious alien obelisk or monolith sort of appear, and the way I interpret that is what we see right after that, after the ape slash man sort of touches it. And I read it as that this is the first time we see him use a weapon of a certain type and turn on his own species.
Right.
So this, to me, that's, I mean, if you want to get into Interp 101,
I'm with you there.
It's the beginning. And sort of also the doom of the species. All right. Cause it turned, then bang, 2001, here we are on the moon. And, it's sending the same obelisk as our monolith is sending, radio transmission to Jupiter. And off the two astronauts go, Dave and Frank, Keir Delay and Gary Lockwood, and then their three hibernating colleagues, plus HAL 9000, the much more human than the human's computer. And then Section 4 sends the surviving member of this mission through a Stargate sequence, and then basically you're wrapping up the end of the species and the beginning of a new one. That's how I read it. It is, as a kid, I saw this film when I was 8 or 9 with my mom, and I remember driving back from Milwaukee with her and asking so many questions about the damn thing in the car that she was not given to crying much, or, you know. But I actually said, well, so what does this mean? What does this mean? What is it? And she actually just pulled over at the side of the road and said, I don't have a single answer for you. I have nothing for you, you know. And I remember seeking out, remember thinking, I gotta have some explanation of that ending.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, puzzled beyond measure, you know, as a kid. And people still are. And when you read the novelization or the novel that Arthur C. Clarke was developing in conjunction with the screenplay. It wasn't like a knockoff novelization of the thing. They really were developed kind of more or less simultaneously. You do get more answers than the movie provides. And
I don't know if I'd want those.
No, I know. And whatever one thinks of this movie, it is stunning to me that it found a huge audience, that a major studio put it out. It's the most radical big studio movie of this entire radical decade, and it found an audience. And nowadays, you get a movie with a little bit of ambition, like Terrence Malick's Tree of Life, which actually has a much more kind of accessible emotional core, this family story, but it has the nerve or the chutzpah or whatever to go back and give you this kind of, you know, dinosaur sequence in the middle of it and all these other kind of trippy elements, mostly visual, but you know, evocative and meaningful, I think. Audiences hated it. They were just like, it's something has happened to audiences in the interim. But it's amazing to me Kubrick found an audience for this thing.
That's interesting you bring up Tree of Life, because I think they're very similar films in a lot of ways and polar opposites too, at least maybe where they're coming from. But that's probably an entirely different discussion. They're both, at least we can say, hugely ambitious films. And sometimes we're put off by seeing that much ambition displayed so obviously on the screen. And so I think Christopher, the listener, he could very well be onto something here. I mean, reading the minds of the director can be a dangerous game, but I think there's very much a possibility that Kubrick means nothing. I mean, in a lot of his films, the most passion you sense is a technical passion for the filmmaking process itself, much less than for the narrative or the story. And so it could very well be that Kubrick is laughing at the audiences as we're gazing up there, seeking for profundity, almost like we're, you know, we're the apes looking up at the monolith. I mean, he does start the film with how many minutes of just a black screen of us gazing up there trying to process it. So I do think that's a possibility. But for me, that does not cut off the other possibility that the film still can mean something to us.
Yeah, sure it does. And I think it's just a question of how it's astoundingly pretentious. I mean, there's no question about it. And
when you title a sequence of your film Beyond the Infinite, that alone is a joke, right?
But sort of. And I think Kubrick, what he's really compelled by as an artist, I think, is in everything, is the nature of human folly. And in this case, he's really just dealing with the folly of the whole species, you know, and nobody seems to be interacting in any kind of meaningful way except through, you know, kind of crisis and violent situations. I mean, so much of Kubrick's films, as we'll talk about later with the top five sequences of, you know, our favorites anyway, it's just about kind of the humankind's war machine and how human conflict is so grisly in its kind of codified, you know, progression in all kinds of battle sequences in everything he's made practically. And I think 2001's kind of a piece of that. Also, he killed off the planet in Dr. Strangelove, and then he essentially does it again more obliquely in 2001. Clearly that guy's got a sense of humor. And I think it is remarkable to me, because I think 2001 ends his most fertile and amazing streak of like 1956 to 1968. It's amazing to me that an artist that's that pitiless and merciless and you know, such a gimlet eye toward human folly and every situation, the characters who are always very small in the scheme of things, even if they're the major characters of the piece, These people are always dwarfed by a hopeless situation of some kind or another, whether it's in wartime or not, or whether or not we're sort of chugging toward the end of the planet Earth's useful lifespan or not. I think that's the kind of satiric, mournful stance that Kubrick comes by naturally. And you can, for some people it works in a film much more straightforward, like Paths of Glory or Spartacus, God knows, which is kind of a studio project. And people are just thrown off by 2001 because it is so non-narratively conventional and just purely imagistic half the time. I was amazed how well it held up for me, I guess, a third, fourth time.
You're listening to Film Spotting and our Sacred Cow discussion of 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. Adam is in the room with us drinking some hot tea, hoping to maybe join us a little bit down the road here in this show. I think you're exactly right when you identify human folly as a central concern throughout Kubrick's career. And the reason why 2001 remains a masterpiece and cemented itself for me as a masterpiece with this latest revisit is because it does not only distill this pessimistic worldview of his that you can trace throughout his other pictures, but expand it as well, as you said, across the entire species, the entire history of that species. I mean, we're going across epochs here and detailing how mankind continually screws it up, even when he's given some sort of gift. There are a couple of patterns that did help me wrap my mind a little bit more around it this time. And one is that pattern throughout Kubrick's career that we both seem to pick up on in terms of human folly. And it's also the pattern within the film, which is fairly clearly evident. People do talk about this movie being mystifying. I think they mainly mean the end, because up until that point, we do see this pattern of the monolith expanding the minds of whoever comes into contact with it. And what that often leads to is some sort of technology. Now, that in and of itself is benign, but what does man do with the technology and their expanded mind? Generally murder or kill, okay? So the prehistoric humans, yes, they use the bone as a tool, but also a tool of death. I would argue in the second section, the mind being expanded is Hal's. That's the one where suddenly becomes sentient and starts to understand what's going on beyond its programming. But what does that make room for? Paranoia and, again, murder. And so if you follow this pattern through, and I think it's interesting that you point out that Kubrick again destroys the world in 2001, because that's how I read it this time too. I don't think that Star Child is a culmination or is a glorious endpoint for mankind, which is what it's sometimes talked about. If we follow this pattern all the way through, in this new form, with whatever new powers and tools are going to be given it, this Star Child, it's going to gobble up Earth,
well,
if anything else.
Partly I'm talking, I've done a little bit of reading on kind of what we don't see in the final version and what Clark and Kubrick, talked about and wrote and rewrote and rewrote. And originally they were trying to deal with a sequence where the Star Child is in either obliquely or explicitly setting off nuclear warheads that are orbiting Earth to destroy the planet.
See, I had no idea of that, and that makes perfect sense to me from what I saw in the finished version.
But who wants that in this film?
I didn't need to see it.
Yeah, now there is...
I feel that vibe, though, from it.
Yeah, and it always struck me oddly that all kinds of critics, Roger Ebert among them, found it a much more optimistic, hopeful picture. And I'm not saying it's hopeless, but the evidence is every other movie he's ever made.
Exactly.
That it's all of a piece. Now, it's how big or important is the film? I almost don't know if those are good questions to ask this film or any film. I just think it's whether or not the spell it casts works for you. And I think for a guy who was so obsessed and preoccupied with finding the right pieces of music to really envelop the audience in his vision of the world, this is one of the reasons the film remains a landmark. I've just never, when I saw this film for the first time, Josh, like everybody who saw it in 1968 or 69, I'd never seen anything like it. And I certainly had never heard music like that eerie, terrifying chorale by a composer named Gheorghe Ligeti that you hear under the sequence set in 2001 where the astronauts are gathering to examine this mysterious monolith uncovered on the moon, and that just that music alone was enough to unnerve me and make me almost afraid to see what was going to happen, but it's just not conventional film music. And again, when you, there's always kind of a parallel story to any great movie, I think. And when you think of a composer like Alex North, one of my favorite film composers, wrote an entire score for this thing, and you can hear snippets of the 2001 score he composed on YouTube. When you see the opening credit sequence that we now know only with that da-da-da, and to hear an entirely different score in this much more kind of grand, adventurous, hey, we're all on a space adventure together, folks, and you think, wow, this doesn't make any damn sense at all for this movie, because you were so used to hearing this fiercely ironic, really, really kind of pitiless musical soundscape for this picture. But, you know, he's not a subtle filmmaker, Cooper.
No.
He's not. And yet, it's just a question of whether or not the grand or blunt ironies he's going for in any of his movies work for you particularly. And I think 2001 was the last film he made where they all worked brilliantly.
Well, and it works so brilliantly that you think something like the Johann Strauss composition seems like it must have been composed to accompany a space docking, right? It's just so perfectly paired that seems to be what it was for. And I think throughout you see this majestic pairing of music, definitely, but also form and technique. And again, going back to Christopher, the listener's suggestion, it could very well be that those are the two things Kubrick is most interested in here, are form and technique. And his worldview that we can trace back through his other films then seeps through to that.
Yeah.
But the primary concern seems to be, you know, he spends so much time just detailing motion in outer space and the ways that mankind has, again, this goes back to technology, tried to master or control this formless void. This is a movie that's just fascinated by that. Think of all the time that's spent documenting action, motion in without gravity. You know, whether it's the flight attendant walking up the wall with the tray and not dropping anything, or whether it's the astronauts jogging in that circle and we get the wonderful use of a tracking camera that we can't figure out how they're doing it, how they recreated that. And to a certain extent, these are the things that the movie is about. And
right.
What makes it, for me, Kubrick's masterpiece is that it melds this fascination with technology with the underlying theme of human folly that he keeps returning to, in that it's exactly this technical aspect that we always seem to mess up.
And it is, that's a good point. And I think, are there things wrong with the film? Certainly from our perspective today, even an ardent admirer of this picture has to readjust their film watching rhythm just to kind of assess for themselves, well, is that space docking sequence, the introduction to the 2001 passages of the picture, are they a little long? Yeah, they are. They're probably over-generous.
I was surprised how quickly this movie went this time for me, to be honest with you.
Okay, but even what about the Stargate sequence where you get those, you know, where you're getting this sort of just essentially a series of—
I was on board. I was completely on board. And you asked probably the most important question when we do these sacred cows for films that are considered masterpieces: is there something wrong here? Can we pick out something that bothers us? And on this revisit, I really couldn't find anything. I think it all, now whether personally you want to sit through that long of a space docking sequence, you're right, that's going to hit each person differently. But in terms of what I think the movie is trying to do, every piece was in place for me.
Well, do you know who was originally cast as the voice of Hal?
Oh.
Martin Balsam.
Okay.
So just sort of a kind of good American actor, typical voice, but when you listen to, it's funny how certain recastings help make this film what it is. I mean
you can't imagine
any other voice.
Hal in any other voice.
Just like in a way you can't imagine hearing any other music than the music you hear in the
Which
picture.
Goes back to, you know, Kubrick's love of technology too, because these are probably among the most robotic performances, and there are quite a few among Kubrick's films that we get, the humans in this film, whether it is the astronauts going to Jupiter or earlier William Sylvester's scientist who's going to the moon. Both of these characters make phone calls home, and they're the most inane birthday sort of calls, and they just reveal these people as soulless, is what I get from it. And then we have Hal, who is given the most emotion, not only because of the voice performance, but because I think that's where the love is for this movie. The love is for the computers and the spaceships and the technology. It's not for the people at all.
Again, I think that's all part of this sort of grand cosmic sick joke, you know, and I think a fantastic one. Hal is, and this has been said a million times, Hal's basically the spurned lover in this romantic triangle. He doesn't like being cut out of these conversations. Unfortunately, he can read lips. And that makes it sort of the strangest little drawing room comedy ever made. It just happens to be set, you know, on the moon and beyond the infinite.
Well, hopefully some listeners have also had a chance to revisit 2001 and can let us know if they agree or disagree with our assessment of it as a masterpiece. Feel free to send us your thoughts at feedback@filmspotting.net or at facebook.com/filmspotting. We will get some sense of what listeners think about 2001 next with the results of the film spotting poll. Plus, we'll have Massacre Theater and a few thoughts from Michael on what he saw at the Toronto International Film Festival. Stay with us. Hey folks, we want to interrupt for a minute to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, you can go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM9. We're also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. And inspired by 2001, our Sacred Cow discussion, I did do a search over at Shutterstock, just looked for space, and actually found 53,886 video clips. And this is true as well. I did a search for Kubrick, and it brought up a slow pan of a room with a patterned floor. So someone out there probably has a good use for that.
Shutterstock has everything you need, whether for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. They have over a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save your video selections that you find to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use the offer code FILM9, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. And for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM9. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
I want to ask you what part of the country you come from.
I originate from Canada. I guess where that is.
Well, I know where Canada is. I've been there myself.
Well, travel for a slave.
Solomon Northup is an expert player on the violin.
I was born a free man, lived with my family in New York.
Be good for your mother.
Until the day I was deceived.
To Solomon.
Kidnapped, sold into slavery.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That was the voice of Chiwetel Ejiofor from 12 Years a Slave, one of the breakout films, possibly the breakout film of the Toronto International Film Festival, which opened last Thursday and closes this weekend. Michael Phillips was there for the opening weekend. He's going to share his thoughts on the fest in just a bit. It is time now, though, for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene. You get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
Try acid, Ray.
Shit.
It's guaranteed.
Shit, Morrison. The last trip was a real bummer, man.
I never had a bummer on acid.
No, I'm trying naturally high.
Yeah, whatever works. Making movies at MGM yet?
Yeah, I got him to see the head of production over there, and he said, "Where's your script?" I said, "I don't need a script. Godard doesn't use a script. He improvises with the camera. This is great." Who's Godard?
I'm off movies, man. Went out to the desert, got lost. I've been living up on Trick's rooftop. Got stuck on a chick.
That was Val Kilmer as Jim Morrison and Kyle MacLachlan as Ray Manzarek in 1991's The Doors, written by Randall Johnson and Oliver Stone, directed by Stone. Adam had a wonderful variation on the ohm for that. And I wonder if that might have been what blew out his vocal cords. I don't know. Possibly. The tie-in there, of course, was that The Doors is a biopic, and we reviewed on the show Wong Kar-wai's The Grand Master, a biopic of martial arts artist Yip Man. If you want to hear that scene, as well as our review of The Grand Master and our lists of the top five anticipated fall movies, you can get the show at filmspotting.net or on iTunes. For some reason, very few entries. I don't know if people just aren't familiar with The Doors. It's not a film you hear discussed much, even in terms of Oliver Stone's career, I think, Michael. But
No. I love it that Stone treats The Doors about as portentously as Kubrick treats The End of the Human Species in 2001.
There is a little bit of a connection there as well. Well, you have the honor, Michael, of digging into the film spotting hat, seeing if you can find a winner. There are a few names in there. Who do we have?
Here we go. It is Dylan Cashbaugh of Los Angeles, California. Congrats.
Congrats, Dylan. Email feedback at filmspotting.com. .net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Oh, yeah, makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Okay, what about you, Chad?
I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block, it's really going to open things up for me.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com. Fandor is a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Filmspotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
Little bit of a complicated scene here, Michael, because it not only has four people. We came into the show thinking we'd have three people to play those four. We are now down, due to Adam's lost voice, to us two handling, well, we might see if Adam can jump in here with maybe two words. One of the parts has two words. Hopefully he can handle that. The vocal cords won't explode.
He can do it. But we're going to play demanding dual roles.
We are.
Like,
yeah.
Alec Guinness. Really, we're really the
a little bit.
Chicago,
yeah.
Alec Guinness.
Yeah, don't set the bar too high for us or anything. There is going to be a specific but loose connection with the film here and Stanley Kubrick's 2001. So there is one hint for you. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, let's get right to it. I'm going to take the opening line here, so go ahead and give me the action.
Okay.
Action. Oh, dear. You're staring at my dress. I should explain. I'm going to the choreographer's ball tonight. There's a prize for the best costume.
And we always win.
I'm not so sure about tonight. I'm supposed to be the Grand Duchess Anastasia, but I think I look more like Tugboat Annie. What do you think?
Well, I...
Now be cruel. Be brutal. Be brutal. Because heaven knows they will. Well, what do you think, Mr. Spring?
Where do you keep your wallet?
And scene. I hope you didn't exhaust yourself there, Michael.
No, that was
those multiple
now
parts.
Who did Adam remind me of in that reading? It's one of the riddles. It's like the monolith. It's not Snake Plissken. It's not Harvey Fierstein.
We'll figure it out by the end of the show.
It's like
the problem is it keeps changing every time he speaks.
I know. It's like if Adrienne Barbeau were like a drag queen, and this was like that drag queen's barber uncle or something.
You might have gotten
it. Is that it? I don't know.
Let's go with that for now.
Okay, that's kind of a reach.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, September 23rd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
That was Aram Khachaturian's Adagio from the jogging scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, a film that we were curious to hear from listeners how they rated it. Not only if they thought it was a masterpiece, that's kind of assumed by most people, but what kind of masterpiece they would describe it as being. So we gave them a couple options here. 2001, A Space Odyssey is a masterpiece that I genuinely love, that I find mystifying, a masterpiece to others, I think it's overrated, or a masterpiece that film spotting confession, I need to see. What did listeners tell us, Michael?
Okay, well, at 12%, very, very interesting tie here. At 12%, we have 12% of the people saying it's a masterpiece to others, I think it's overrated. That tied with the 12% saying that film spotting confession, I need to see it. Okay, they haven't seen it yet. Then at 28%, it's a masterpiece I find mystifying. Doesn't mean they hate it or love it. They just, they're mystified. You know, you're not alone. And then the number one by far, 47%, it's a masterpiece that I genuinely love. So there's honest to God love for this film.
And M.P. Lee is in that group. He wrote to us to say, I consider this the best film ever made. I first saw it when it was originally released. I was 11 and enthralled to the U.S. space program, and this seemed our destiny. I've seen the film more than a dozen times and love it each time. The last 20 minutes, the Cosmic Light Show, I'm still considering, but I'm at peace with it now.
He's identified, I think, the weakness of the film, but not enough to kill it. Joshua in upstate New York, not you, Josh.
No, but, not me.
Joshua in upstate New York says, I watched 2001 for the first time when I was about 16 and found it intriguing but very boring. I watched it again as a freshman in college because I decided to write a research paper on the film and its perceived meaning. While I still found myself being crushed under the weight of its expansive universe, I built up a great appreciation for the film that I still can't quite wrap my head around despite all my research. I only got a B on the paper, which proves I have a ways to go to fully grasp what I experience when I watch it. I only got a B.
Only a B. We'll give him B plus, maybe A minus for his note, though. Thank you, Joshua. We also heard from Corey H. in Moscow, who said he's never been more conflicted with a movie. It's a great film if you turn it off before the last 20 minutes or so. I just always seem to forget that. It's a favorite when I started, and then by the time it's finished, I've sworn it off for good. In its defense, 2001 has one of the creepiest shots ever. That lingering camera behind the astronauts as they make their way down the ramp to see the monolith on the moon. Just talking about it makes me shudder. Kubrick made some of the most unsettling scenes ever. The orgy in Eyes Wide Shut, Danny's visit to room 237, half of A Clockwork Orange. But nothing compares to that music and the feeling of being there in the presence of something as otherworldly as that monolith. See? Defending a movie I swore off like a dog to its vomit.
Wow, Corey. The Toast of Moscow. Corey, that's
there you go.
Beautiful. Dave C. in Rochester, New York, who's, I'm sure Dave C. is also the Toast of Rochester. I didn't love 2001 until I saw it for a second time on a bigger screen. I'm all in now. Some films inspire excitement or fear or laughter or sadness, but how many inspire awe? 2001 is the cinematic equivalent of summiting a mountain and taking in the view.
That big screen does help, that's for sure. Adam saw it on a very tiny screen, I remember him saying, in college in his dorm room. And El Goro, host of the Talk Without Rhythm movie podcast, he wrote in to say he had a similar experience. Much like Adam, I also saw 2001 during my college years on a small screen in my dorm room, an experience that left me fairly befuddled as to its elevated status amongst cinephiles. But through the years and subsequent rewatches on larger screens, I gradually came to appreciate and finally love Kubrick's definitive statement on speculative science fiction. 2001 is a movie of ideas, not only what Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick overtly present, but also what you bring to the experience. As you age and hopefully become more refined in your thinking, 2001 will continue to question and challenge your perception of self and your place in the grand tableau of human experience. It is, in a word, a masterpiece. Though I still prefer A Clockwork Orange. Elevated philosophy is all well and good, but sometimes you just need a bit of the old ultra-violence.
Theo from Boise said, not only do I genuinely love 2001, it's, in my opinion, Kubrick's best film, and it rests near the top of my top 10 most essential films. It was the first, quote, big movie I ever saw. My dad forced my brother and I to watch it when we were in elementary school. I was knocked out even then. The 2001 had the guts to start a science fiction movie thousands of years in the past on the plains of Africa. I was surprised when neither Josh, Adam, nor Michael had it or any other Kubrick film in their top 10 lists back in episode 410. Wow, this guy's really listening. Kubrick would be rolling in his grave if not for the fact that his mind had been assimilated into the wallpaper in The Shining.
So Theo's note, that prompted Sam, our producer, to ask us this question and to say, since we didn't have it in our top tens when we got together to talk about those lists of all time, would you put it there now after having re-seen it again?
I'd probably put it in my top 26. 26 or 27. I don't know if it may be my top 10.
We'll get back to us on whether it's 26 or 27.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it might be the nagging, you know, extra 4 or 5 minutes of that Stargate sequence that I don't think the world needs.
When it hits the landscapes, is that when you're out? Because it's pretty much lights, and then all of a sudden we start getting these funky landscapes.
And Arizona and such,
but
with different color washes.
Right.
It's a little Bally High South Pacific for me, that section, yeah.
For me, I would definitely, I didn't even have it in my top 20. It's definitely going in the top 20 after this rewatch. I don't think it could crack the top 10, however. Thanks to all the listeners who did voice in with their opinions on this poll. We've got another poll for you right now because we're looking ahead to an interview that Adam was able to do with Sam Rockwell for his new film, A Single Shot, that we're going to be sharing with you here soon. And we want to know, what is your favorite Sam Rockwell performance? We got a couple options for you here.
Okay, Chuck Barris in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Guy Fleegman in Galaxy Quest. I love that. Frank Mercer, Matchstick Men, Sam Bell in Moon, Billy in Seven Psychopaths, or Other.
All right, Michael, we've just been putting you on the spot here in this segment, so go ahead and give us your answer for this poll.
I go Other because I love Snow Angels, David Gordon Green's film,
really?
Snow Angels, and I think Rockwell's terrific in that. Although he's great fun in this film, The Way, Way Back this summer. Not a film I loved, but Rockwell's such a good time in that. He's a real sturdy, versatile character.
Yeah, he's
character
great.
Man. Yeah, great.
Yeah, that Snow Angels surprise pick, I would probably go with probably Sam Bell in Moon. I know that's a favorite of listeners, but a film that I like better, actually, is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. So it's between those two. I might have to go with the George Clooney film and Rockwell's performance as Chuck Barris. We do want to hear what listeners think, so go ahead to filmspotting.net. You'll find the poll and cast your vote. All right, Michael, before we move on, can you give us a quick rundown here of the Toronto International Film Festival? You're literally off the plane there for the beginning of the fest. What stood out to you? Any lowlights? Any highlights?
I mean, every festival, Josh, of any size, you sort of attack it the way you choose to attack it. And the way I did Toronto this year was essentially seeing a lot of the big movies just a few weeks or so before they open. That seems like kind of a crazy thing to do, but this is kind of just for various reasons the way I hit it. And one of the real highlights really was one of the ones that made the biggest kind of awards buzz sound, which was Steve McQueen's new film, 12 Years a Slave, which is a screen version of the 1850s memoir written by Solomon Northup, who was a freeborn northerner living in Saratoga, New York. A violinist by vocation, and he goes to Washington, D.C. This is a true story. And he's essentially kidnapped and then removed down to Louisiana and into plantation slave life for 12 years before his improbable rescue from this miserable situation and his return to a family who's basically almost forgotten him 12 years later. It's a stunning story. It's a memoir I finally, thank God, had an excuse to read myself because of this film, and had good interviews with Chiwetel Ejiofor, plays Solomon, with McQueen, who I'd never talked to in person.
Would you say it feels like a Steve McQueen film?
It does. It does. And I like his earlier pictures, Hunger and Shame. Shame a little less. I think that's kind of a granite-fisted movie. It's the most, I'm not looking for jokes with that particular subject, but I just think Hunger is the better of the two. I think it's a really, it shows, this new film, Josh, 12 Years a Slave, shows how his visual style, and he's trained in more than one visual medium. He's a video artist. He's also a visual artist of various types. He's got a very sort of flexible and old school visual approach to this. This is really kind of like classical Hollywood filmmaking without a lot of the bombast and puffery and without a lot of money. They shot this very convincing period picture on location in Louisiana for about $20 million. Now, that sounds like a hell of a lot of money to most indie filmmakers, but it's...
For a period piece, too.
Yeah, it really just, on a first viewing, I can just say it's a lot of it's difficult to stomach, very hard to watch, but none of it... To me, it sort of is the corrective we needed after Django Unchained. I know a lot of people who liked...
I know
a ton of people who like Django Unchained a lot better than 12 Years a Slave, and there was a lot of good discussions about this line up at Toronto. But no, I like this one a great deal.
Do you happen to know the Chicago release date for that?
I think it's October 18th, unless they monkey around with the release date. But it's really, it feels like it's going to be, for whatever this is worth, due for multiple Oscar nominations. and deservedly so, I think.
Well, and that's one Adam and I are both anticipating, so we'll hopefully get a chance to review it here in the show. Up next, Michael and I are going to share our top five Kubrick scenes. I don't know about you, Michael, but I rewatched mine with tiny pliers holding my eyes open.
Ouch.
Stay with us.
Hi there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Matt Singer from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. In our latest episode, Allison Wilmore and I move to Reno to begin new lives as we discuss This is Martin Bonner.
And inspired by that film, we'll also offer up recommendations for some other films about starting over that are available online for streaming or rental. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Todd Haynes, the director of I'm Not There, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Und als man ihm die Botschaft bracht, dass sein Herzliebchen im Sterben lag, da ließ all sein Hab und Gut und eilte seinem Herzliebchen zu. Da ließ all sein Hab und Gut.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson alongside Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. That was The Faithful Hussar being sung by a German prisoner entertaining French soldiers before they go back to the front in Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory. That was a very popular choice among listeners who gave us some feedback via Facebook or emails when we set out to name our top five Stanley Kubrick scenes. And these lists are among my favorite top fives that we get to do, digging into a filmmaker's career and picking out those scenes that do matter the most to us. And this was just a wealth, because I think when you bring up a Stanley Kubrick movie, there are these perfectly calibrated segments, a little bit like Spielberg, I'd say, in this way, that do stand out from the films and just settle into your memory. I don't know if you found that to be the case with his pictures, Michael.
Yeah. In some cases, you're talking about very, very discreet showcase sequences. But I guess my top five, Josh, a lot of it was just more just about his compositional strengths, all coming from his training as a photographer for Life magazine and other sources. Yeah, it just stood him in such great stead for his vision of the world, this sort of like tunnel vision, you know, very kind of obsessive, feverishly controlled, you know, vision of the world. And you know, just like Jerry Lewis says in Naughty Professor, every move a picture. And yet, at his best, I think, it's not just pictorialism on screen. It really is cinema. And I guess in some things, and maybe we'll get into this debate, because I know you have at least one from Barry Lyndon on your list.
Which, there's a lot of pictorialism in that
one.
Yeah,
and I'd argue it's the kind of cinema that film represents or is into is a little by design, kind of desiccated and a little, it's not the Kubrick stuff I love the most. But anyway, yeah, that's
all
the
right
stuff.
Well, with that framework, let's go ahead and get right to it. What do you have as your number five?
Okay, the number five is really almost any scene around that harshly lit table with Sterling Hayden and Elijah Cook Jr. and all these other schemers in the 1956 crime drama The Killing.
You mean there's going to be two other guys in on the deal and we ain't going to know who they are?
That's right. You don't know who they are and they don't know who you are. That makes sense to you, doesn't it?
Yes, I guess so, but I...
Makes sense to me, all right.
How come we need them, though, Johnny? What are they going to do?
One of them's for the job with a rifle. None of you boys can handle that, even if you were willing to. And the other one starts the fight in the bar.
These other fellas, how much are they cutting in for? Not that I mind. Anything you do is okay, but...
These men are not going to be in on the basic scheme. They're getting paid to perform certain definite duties at a certain definite time, and they're not cutting in on the take.
This is a film shot in just amazing black and white that it's showing you in every shot, you know, where this filmmaker is going to go the whole rest of his career. It is such a merciless, pitiless arrangement of bodies in space. It's coming straight out of his work earlier from films. Well, he made two features before this. One of them, Killer's Kiss, is kind of a good warm-up, another black and white crime drama, which you should see if you've never seen Killer's Kiss. It doesn't get a lot of currency, but there's a sequence, at least one, I think, set in the old Pennsylvania Station in New York, which is long gone now. And it's a marvelous artifact. And that's what that movie is good for. It's an artifact. It's a series of evocations of New York in the early 50s. And most of that city's gone now. But it's a great warm-up for The Killing. And I just love the way these actors simply look with this the light of judgment, sort of like it's almost like one of those police station lights on them every second, even though they're just trying to make the big score and get out of there for the racetrack robbery. Anyway, it's not a distinct sequence, Josh, really. It's just more the look of that film announced itself as here is a director who's going places.
Well, I'm glad you found a place for The Killing, because it is a picture of his that I do like. Didn't find a place on my list, though, as Barry Lyndon did. That's where I'm going to go with my number five, and it is The Climactic Duel. This is Kubrick's adaptation of the 1844 Thackeray novel about an opportunistic Irishman played by Ryan O'Neill. It follows his rising and falling fortunes across 18th century Europe. And Lyndon finds himself involved in a number of duels over the years, or at least there are a number of duels in the picture. This final one, though, I think is the most transformative and personal that we get. I won't give away the details, because I think this is a little bit of an underseen Kubrick picture. Mm-hmm. Just to say, though, that this duel contains what is possibly the only selfless act that Barry Lyndon makes in the entire film. Otherwise, this guy's just a ruthless survivalist throughout history, or at least his personal history. And yet, even though this is where the Kubrick comes in, even though he does make this selfless act, we also get a dark irony in the way he's repaid for it. So all of that is in this scene. And of course, we also have what you'd expect, the staging being so precise and perfect, the way the witnesses to the duel are positioned in the frame and how they lay out the rules, the positions that the duelists take themselves in. This looks like it's an abandoned church that this is taking place in. So it's incredibly tense, yet also has that black humor. There's the touch of the pigeons fluttering about in the background, and you know they jump up when a shot is fired, but otherwise go back about their business as if whatever these silly humans are doing doesn't really matter.
It's essentially the only spontaneity in the entire 3-hour picture, but again, by design. It's a film, you know, Barry Lyndon is a film I really went for when it first came out when I was 14, 15. I was such a sucker for any period picture of any sort of size and level of accomplishment. Certainly that is a very accomplished picture in many ways. I find I can't get in that one just because of Ryan O'Neill, for God's sake.
Well, yeah, he's awful. I think by intent, which we could talk about, and we could also talk about how I think the Academy Awards were a sucker for that sort of picture at the time, which is why Lyndon received four of them, when I think it's really lampooning the entire genre. So this was, you know, a fun watch for me because I had not seen it before the first time, and I did get on board with it.
Saw it again recently. It's been a long time. You know what I needed to do, though, Josh? I needed to see it on a big screen again, and it's been a while. It's been decades since I've seen it properly.
I do wish I could have done that. All right, what's your number four?
My number four would be there's a couple of individual snippets, little shots in The Shining, which is a film I'm quite ambivalent about in many ways. I don't think it's one of his great ones, but somehow that recurring image of the blood gushing out of the elevator is just one of the great images of modern horror. And the only thing I like better in the film is, I guess, my number four, which is that mysterious shot of Nicholson looking down at the model of the Overlook Hotel maze, when we see the live human beings, you know, sort of running around desperately in it. Now, two things. is this in his mind? Is it really happening? And B, how did they accomplish this technically? Now, you can find the answers to this, but it as this thing comes and goes, just in a few seconds of screen time, it's scary and funny and mysterious, and it's actually a very complex moment because it's frankly playful, and there's not much in that film that has any kind of light touch. But that little bit does. And that's Kubrick, the technical trickster, and also just kind of the guy pulling the strings saying, you know, ha, 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 all these foolish people about to die.
Yeah, my pick from The Shining is a quick shot, too. I think you're right. That's largely what the movie is composed of. But I'm not going to get to that quite yet. For my number four, it's The Tour of the Trenches in Paths of Glory, which I consider to be Kubrick's breakout film. It's set in the French trenches of World War I. And early on, we get this reverse tracking shot tour of these trenches as a French general played by George McReady goes from soldier to soldier, and he's trying to embolden them before battle.
Good morning. Hello there, soldier. Ready to kill more Germans?
Yes, sir.
Working over your rifle, I see. Well, that's the way. It's a soldier's best friend. You be good to it, and it'll always be good to you.
Yes, sir.
Good luck to you, soldier. Carry on.
What's interesting about this is it's really structured as a joke in a lot of ways. You get this repeated question, ready to kill more Germans, and the drum roll that stops when he's talking to them and then picks up again as he moves forward to the next soldier. Mm-hmm. It does help to emphasize, I think, the insanity of it all, to play it as this kind of macabre joke.
Hello there, soldier. Ready to kill more Germans? That is, everything all right, soldier?
All right. Yes, sir, I'm all right.
Good fella. Are you married, soldier?
Married? Me married?
Yes, have you got a wife?
A wife? Have I got a wife?
He's a bit shell-shocked.
I beg your pardon, Sergeant. There is no such thing as shell-shock. Have you got a wife, soldier?
My wife? My wife? Yes, I have a wife. I'm never going to see her again. I'm going to be killed.
Get a grip on yourself. You're acting like a coward.
I am a coward, sir.
Snap out of it, soldier.
Notice also at the end of this scene, the general's confrontation with this so-called coward. Up to that point, we had been tracking a reverse shot, so we're leading the general in a way. And here the camera cuts, and we start tracking him from behind. So we're no longer in this sort of forward-leading perspective of respect, it feels like to me. All of a sudden, we're looking at him from behind. We have this sense of voyeurism and suspicion. So I just love that little twist Kubrick puts
there.
That's
a good reading of it. And that's actually my number three is the same.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, it is. There's something about the trench sequences in Paths of Glory that, again, those are shots that really announce themselves as a new way to kind of take you into that particular scene. I think Kubrick was obsessed with the war machine in general. It goes right back to his first feature, Fear and Desire, which I just saw for the first time. You know, a very early, you know, and kind of rough around the edges effort set in kind of a no man's land of an undetermined, unspecified war. It wasn't made that long after World War II, but you know, right through all these pictures, Spartacus and, you know, in a much more comic vein, Dr. Strangelove, you know, the battalion sequences in Barry Lyndon. He loved this idea of showing just how many ridiculous and kind of appalling ways there are to kill hundreds of men at one time in the name of, you know, one cause or another. He never got tired. And, of course, Full Metal Jacket, too, a film I hadn't seen for years and years. I just went back to. And, frankly, that one actually rose in my estimation. Didn't end up in my top five in any way, but that one's looking better to me now.
All right. Well, maybe you'll get a chance to mention a scene in honorable mentions. For my number three, you did reference it already. It's the bloody elevators in The Shining. Probably Danny's big wheel ride would be my pick, but we spent a lot of time talking about that, or at least I did when we revisited The Shining and talked about the documentary on the film Room 237. So I'm going to go with the bloody elevators instead for this list. I think it's a good substitute, this recurring image. We get it at least twice in the film of blood just rushing out from these elevator doors. Now, Room 237 spent a lot of time, as others have, trying to decipher the meaning of right?
No,
like, what
is it all mean? Already. It's like over-interpreting.
I'm not going to do that. I want to focus on
blood coming out of elevators, man.
That's all you need?
It's good enough.
But it's interesting to look at the horrifying aesthetics of the shot itself and just what those do to us. And I noticed revisiting it, which I'm sure I saw the first time, but didn't remember, that the doors never bother to open. It comes out of the side of them.
That's why it's cool.
And there's something extra intrusive about that, yeah. Extra invasive.
Yeah.
So there's so much blood,
it doesn't even need the doors
right.
to open.
It's going to come in no matter what. Yeah, yeah. And also the detail that the doors are painted this primary red. I think what that does is when the blood comes out, it's this slick, deep red, right? So it gives the blood more of a vital feel. It's more like a life force when compared to that kind of childish primary red of the doors. And then, of course, what we remember is that in the one sequence, the camera holds it as the blood keeps coming and eventually it just spills over the camera. So we're pretty much drowned in it.
Yeah.
I think if The Shining is partly a deconstruction of the horror genre, a little game Kubrick's playing, that could very well be what he's doing here. This moment kind of said, okay, if these movies run on blood, you haven't seen anything yet. And then he gives
right.
us this.
Right, that's right. And I still say I've stayed in worse hotels. So
you're listening to Film Spotting. That is Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. I'm Josh Larson. And we're sharing our top five Stanley Kubrick scenes. We've hit most of the big movies so far. Let's see, another title for number two, Michael?
My number two, you know, Kubrick, Josh, is not known for necessarily giving free rein to his actors, although he's worked with amazing actors when you look at the collective casts of something like Dr. Strangelove and others. But my number two, the scene I find astonishingly funny and strange still is that scene from Lolita, his 1962 adaptation of the Nabokov novel, where Peter Sellers is on the porch as Quilty, just trying to unnerve and kind of undermine and get wheedle information about this nymphette out of James Mason.
Tell me, when you were standing there at the desk checking in with the night manager, Mr. George Swine, who I happen to know is a personal friend of mine, I was wondering if he fixed you up with sort of good accommodation here.
Yes, they were extremely cooperative.
You're quite sure about that? Because, I mean, I could really easily have a word with George Schwein. I mean, he's a really normal, nice sort of guy, and I've only got to have a normal word in his ear, and you'd be surprised what things could happen from a thing like that. I mean, he'd probably go and turn some of the troopers out so you could have a lovely room, a bridal suite for you and your lovely little girl.
No, please, I don't want you to take any trouble on my account. We're perfectly comfortable.
And that scene between Sellers and Mason on that porch, where Sellers keeps talking about that George Swine, you know, the proprietor of the hotel and all that. I haven't seen this in a while, but it is Sellers at his best, and yet it is completely true to the spirit of the novel. And it's Mason, the look on his face as an actor is just like, what is going on with Sellers? And, you know, can I even keep up with this guy? And those are two marvelously matched actors. I love that scene. And it's atypically great for Kubrick because it does give the actors, it really lets them run the show, and you're not even really conscious of kind of how things are framed or where the actors are in the position of the frame, although it's perfect.
Well, I did my Barry Lyndon homework, but I'll confess I was not able to get to Lolita. I have yet to see that one. But my number two pick, it also focuses on the acting, which I'd agree is a rarity in terms of standing out from his films. And this is Nicole Kidman's Confession from Eyes Wide Shut. It's Kubrick's final film, an explicit exploration of marriage and sexuality. But for all the frankness it has, for all the sexual elements it has, what lingers most from this film for me are actually two conversations. One is between Tom Cruise and Sidney Pollack, and then this pick between Cruise and Kidman, where they were married at the time, of course, and here they are playing an affluent married couple. In this scene, they're sort of grilling each other about past indiscretions and tiptoeing around things and revealing things. And Kidman's character does confess that about a year earlier, she had flirted with a naval officer, and she confesses she was perfectly willing to let it lead to this full-fledged affair. It didn't, but she would have been happy if that had happened.
I barely slept that night. And I woke up the next morning in a panic. I didn't know whether I was afraid that he had left or that he might still be there.
This is, I think, you know, one of those rare times where Kubrick just lets the actor act. The camera it's relatively static here, and Kidman comes through with this powerhouse performance. It is partly a confession that she's making, but it's also a bit of a brag that she's doing to her husband. It's certainly a provocation of him. And as all of this is going on, I think Cruise is very good at this moment, too. He's very still, and you sense part of that is from the shock, but he also has this, which Cruise brings to a lot of his action roles, but it works here. He's coiled as well. It's almost like he's so still, but you can tell he's ready to spring in some sort of maybe violent action. And really, the rest of the film is sort of him doing that in response to this lengthy, static revelation scene that Kubrick
gives
us.
That's such a bizarre film. I have to see it again. I didn't really get the hang of it the first time, and it may never be for me. And I couldn't get over the fact that it just seemed to be I thought at the time it needed to belong in the period in which was Arthur Schnitzler, the Austrian novelist and short story writer, wrote it. It would make sense to me in the 19 sort of in this decadent sort of, you know, between the wars sort of period in Vienna. I couldn't get on board with this.
Felt a little out of time, maybe.
And of course, you know, one of the fascinations about Kubrick just as a director is that he's in the case of Eyes Wide Shut, he's recreating parts of New York City in a patently artificial way as he's filming back in his home turf in England.
It's airless. That's
airless,
for sure.
And it's deliberate, and it actually is so strange. It is a style unto itself, and it's the same style he, in a funny way, you can look at something like Full Metal Jacket from 1987, where he's recreating whole chunks of Vietnam on a soundstage in England. And it's not, on the one hand, it's meant to be realistic, and there's an awful lot of authentic detail going on. And in another sense, it doesn't look realistic at all. But that's also one of the great appeals of this filmmaker. It's not, he is not into realism. He may know what documentary realism means, and sometimes he does approximate it in that he's going for like newsreel type footage in certain films, especially when he switches to handheld and all that. But he's creating his own little universe always anew, and it's never really meant to be quite like the planet we live on.
All right, we're down to our number one picks. Michael, what is your top Stanley Kubrick scene?
I had to go off the planet to pick my number one. So maybe 2001, A Space Odyssey is, maybe it is his masterpiece. I'm not sure. But my favorite scene in that, again, partly because of the music, is just so brilliantly chosen, is I love the introduction to the Jupiter space sequence where we meet the two astronauts played by Keir Dillay and Gary Lockwood, and just kind of, you know, the jogging sequence in that astounding technical, you know, the just feat of magic, really. How did they take that? How did they get that shot? But the between the music and this creeping sense of loneliness and futility as we sort of realize what's up with this mission, and then we meet Hal and all that. But it's that first few minutes of that Jupiter sequence that I think is the most haunting stuff in the picture. And that's the one that, when I saw it again recently, I thought, "Wow, this is the right marriage of technological wonder in filmmaking to a storytelling purpose." And it's unsettling even today in ways you can't quite put your finger on.
Yeah, I had to go with 2001 for my number one pick.
We do love this
well.
Film.
We love this film quite a bit. It's going to be Hal reading lips, actually. That's the one in my recent revisit that stood out to me. But I think looking at it again, there are so many scenes to pick from. Looking at it again another time, it could be something else. But this time, this is the scene I love. Now, Hal is often talked about being the emotional center of the film, right? Partly because everyone else in the movie is so robotic. He gets the best death scene, so that plays on our sympathies too. And there's this definitive moment, though, before that death scene, where we feel empathy for him. I think it happens well before the plug is pulled. Now, after Keir Dillay and Gary Lockwood's astronauts do become suspicious of Hal, they get into one of the space pods, and they think Hal can't hear him there, and that's where we're going to discuss this possibility of shutting him down.
You know, another thing just occurred to me. Well, as far as I know, no 9,000 computers have been disconnected.
Well, no 9,000 computers ever fouled up before.
That's not what I mean. Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure what you think about it.
Here's what happens. The camera switches to Hal's point of view. And previously this point of view, we've seen it before, but it was represented by this distorted circular window at the center of the screen. Things are not quite clear, and certainly the entire screen is shut off. But here, as soon as we see Hal's perspective of them in the pod, it clarifies a little bit. That circle gets a little more clear, and it closes in on the men's lips. And then we get those frantic swish pans from one to the other as they talk. We didn't get anything like that before. And in that instant, for me, that's when Hal goes from this remote piece of hardware to an understandably paranoid human. It doesn't matter that we want to know what they're saying. Just those swish pans alone make us feel paranoid too.
The spurned lover.
Exactly.
And, I mean, there's two big delineations in 2001: A Space Odyssey, when man turns on man with a weapon in the first sequence, and when computer turns on man in this sequence. And those two things are kind of the epical progressions of the human species, according to Kubrick. And
all thanks to that pesky monolith.
Exactly.
Do you have any honorable mentions you want to share, Michael?
I guess my honorable mention, Josh, would be another Peter Sellers moment. This one, again, very famous from Dr. Strangelove, more famous than my pick from Lolita, actually. But I think his telephone call on the hotline, on the red phone to Moscow, as President Merkin Muffling. Sellers' talk with Dimitri, we've talked about this before, I think, on Film Spotting. I just think that's Kubrick just gets out of the way of a fantastic actor, and that the monologue is brilliantly written, and it is great to be fine, as he says. And, you know, there's been a little problem with setting off the missiles, and it's an unusually great moment for Kubrick, I think, just because he does kind of stop and sit back a little bit and just say, okay, Sellers, go. And I mean, that was a really inspired match that at least that actor and that director got to work together twice. Wonderful effect both times.
I had a couple honorable mentions here. I did talk about the big wheel ride in The Shining. The discovery of tools as well, I think, is great from 2001. It's just this moment where you can sense there's a shiver going through the universe after that. And then I also picked specifically from the opening segment of Full Metal Jacket, Private Pyle's obstacle course montage. I just think the way Kubrick has a field day with tracking shots and crane shots there. So
I do love, you know, I love the first minute of Full Metal Jacket. I think that the haircut montage is really, and it's unusual for him because it's really, the cutting is quicker than usual. It's just arresting. And I don't know if Full Metal Jacket is really a masterwork, or if, again, I sort of have a Ryan O'Neill problem with Matthew Modine in the middle of it. It's just not enough of an actor for me, but I love that first minute. You know, another film we didn't talk about, which I have a huge affection for, is Spartacus, which he took over from.
Is there a scene from that jumps to mind?
No. Okay. The whole thing, you know, he finished it. He took over from Anthony Mann on that one, and in a funny way, it's a less personal picture because he didn't really conceive it. He was really kind of a gun for hire on that, but it's a really good script showcasing a really good performance by Kirk Douglas, and it's the only movie set in that time period that really means anything to me now. I think it just feels completely vital and alive, and it's got one of the great musical scores of the epic genre, and I love it. And I think, and similarly, it's not a film he finished because he turned it over to Steven Spielberg. But AI is a film that took me two shots to get the hang of. It seems to be growing a little bit in my estimation. Not that the film needs my estimation, but I think that one's holding up better and better.
Yeah, I do love AI. Those are our top five Stanley Kubrick scenes. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting. I don't know how many of these wide releases you've already seen, Michael, but maybe you can give us a mini review here. We've got The Family opening, about a mafia family that gets relocated to Normandy, France. Stars Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Tommy Lee Jones. It's directed by Luc Besson. I hear it's one of the most highly anticipated films of 1993.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm willing to declare it a high masterpiece.
Okay, good. How about Insidious Chapter 2, the sequel to the 2010 horror film with Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne? This is directed by James Wan, who also made this year's The Conjuring. We both like The Conjuring.
Like The Conjuring, and I like the first Insidious. And this was one of these weird screening flukes where I think I have to actually choose which one I'm going to see tomorrow night, The Family or Insidious 2.
Can I push you towards Insidious too?
I don't know. We'll see. I got a check from the people who made The Family, though, so I may have to go.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I understand. Yeah. Limited release opening here in Chicago. A couple films. The Muslims Are Coming, a documentary about Muslim American comics doing a tour of Middle America. Populaire, which is a workplace comedy set in 50s France. a teacher, about a teacher's life that begins to unravel when her affair with a student ends, and Short Term 12. This is about a young woman working at a foster care facility battling her own demons. It stars Brie Larson, and that is the film we hope to review coming up here on the show. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. And thanks beyond the normal thanks, Michael, for joining us, because literally, with Adam's voice, if you hadn't been here tonight, there wouldn't have been a show, or it would have just been me babbling on and on about 2001 to myself.
Which, thanks, no, it's fun. Adam, I really appreciate the laryngitis, and you know, I think we all certainly enjoyed Adam's silence more than his words. You know,
we'll see.
That's how I feel. About
we'll
it.
See what the feedback is. I imagine you've got some work up at chicagotribune.com/movies about the Toronto Film Festival. Anything else people should be looking for from you?
I'm fortunate to be hosting Friday Night Spotlight this month in September on Turner Classic Movies, and we're showing, among other things, AI, which we just talked about.
So, oh, really?
Yes, these are future. We're calling it Future Shock. It's movies set in the future, and in some cases, like Escape from New York, it's a film made a while back set in what is now the past, 1997.
Awesome. Sounds good. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Well, Adam's been on the bench here on injured reserve, nursing his throat, but he did want to attempt to weigh in at least with his picks. He put in all the work, put in all the viewing. And so maybe, Adam, can you give it a try and at least list your scenes? This is going to be like the biggest challenge of your life.
This would be as if the monolith spoke.
There we go.
Thus spake Adam.
With that set up.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Holy cow.
I really don't know how I can disappoint you and not give it a shot here. Wow, how bad do I sound? Josh, I'm with you. My number five, same sequence from Barry Lyndon, Lord Bullingdon, Satisfaction, that final duel. Number four, Boot Camp, the opening Boot Camp from Full Metal Jacket with Arlie Ermey. Number three, The Big Wheel, the twins from The Shining, terrifying. Number two, we heard it, The Faithful Hussar from Paths of Glory. And my number one, the most cliche, obvious pick ever, but had to be it, 2001, I'm with you. The Bone to Satellite, the match cut, but everything about that watering hole sequence leading up to that. Number one.
All right.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Hey,
that was fine.
He did it all in a minute. We're like yak, yak, yak with our, you know.
This show could be a lot quicker if he was like that every week.
Comes in, you know. He's working on the Woody Allen pace, not the Kubrick pace, you know. He's just bing, bing, bing. Let's go.
This might be a good time to talk about the song that you actually wrote about 2001. I'm not going to ask you to sing it now, but we do have a recording of it. Maybe we'll hear just a little bit of it.
Benson Fuller! What a weird one! Baby.